The third case for oral argument this morning is Larry D. Griffiths, appellant versus Harry Hoas, as I'm pronouncing that correctly. Appellee for the appellant is Mr. Reed Rasmussen, an attorney from Aberdeen, South Dakota, and for the appellee is Mr. John Wiles, an attorney from Watertown, South Dakota. Mr. Rasmussen, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Morning. This is a case involving a breakup of a business relationship. The plaintiff, Mr. Hoas, Mr. Wiles' client, and my client, Mr. Griffiths, were the owners of a business known as the Grand Casino in Watertown. They were the two shareholders of that business, my client being the majority shareholder, owning 51% of the stock, and Mr. Hoas owning the remainder of the stock. Mr. Hoas was the manager of the casino and served in that capacity for several years. In February of 1996, my client was involved in a serious motor vehicle accident which left him debilitated for at least a couple of years, and therefore his involvement in the business in the years 96, 97, 98 was very limited. It was eventually determined that between 1997 and 1999, approximately $135,000 of cash from the business was found to be missing. My client believed that that was a result of Mr. Hoas stealing the money, and therefore in October of 1999 he fired Mr. Hoas from the position of manager of the casino. The casino continued under the same ownership through the end of 2001, when Mr. Griffiths sold the business for $100,000 to another party. He did not at that time provide Mr. Hoas with his 49% share of the sale proceeds, nor did he provide Mr. Hoas with his share of the corporate profits for the years 2000 and 2001, which equaled about $9,000. So when all is said and done, Mr. Griffiths withheld from Mr. Hoas about $58,000. Mr. Hoas then subsequently brought a lawsuit against Mr. Griffiths seeking to recover the funds that Mr. Griffiths had withheld from him. An attempt was made by Mr. Griffiths at that point, who was represented by someone else, to assert a counterclaim to allege that to attempt to recover the money that Mr. Griffiths claimed Mr. Hoas had stolen from the casino while he was serving as manager. And in fact, a case was commenced at one point on behalf of the corporation. That case wound up being dismissed for failure to prosecute. So Mr. Hoas then had also filed bankruptcy. So when the effort was
dismissed with prejudice or without?
It was dismissed with prejudice. Well, I take that back here. I think it was without prejudice, but by the time the prior attorney recognized that it had been dismissed, the bankruptcy had been completed and discharged, and so I think he was precluded from reasserting that claim by the result of the bankruptcy.
Can you explain how these claims survived the bankruptcy?
Well, I think the only thing that survived the bankruptcy was a set-off claim under the authority of I think it's 11 U.S.C. 553. We were not allowed to pursue a counterclaim, nor was the corporation allowed to reassert the lawsuit that had been dismissed because of the discharge and bankruptcy. But the trial court ruled, I believe, correctly, and it's not an issue in this appeal.
Was your client's claim, it survived?
It survived to the extent that he could assert a set-off against the plaintiff. He was not allowed to assert a counterclaim and recover any money against the plaintiff.
Mm-hmm.
As it turned out, the money that the jury determined the plaintiff took was more than my client withheld from him, but we were not allowed to collect any of that.
Mm-hmm. The personal claim that the plaintiff has against the corporation or Mr. Griffiths, how did that survive the bankruptcy? How did he get it back from the bankruptcy?
I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, but that was worked out in the bankruptcy. The bankruptcy trustee was part of that, and Mr. Wiles was hired by the bankruptcy trustee to pursue that claim on behalf of the bankruptcy estate.
Okay, so this claim now is being presented in Mr. Hoas's name on behalf of the bankruptcy?
I think there's some evidence in the record that Mr. Hoas will receive, you know, if he gets money, he gets a portion of it and the bankruptcy gets a portion of it. There was an agreement worked out between the trustee and Mr. Hoas in that regard.
Is 553 shed any light on the legal nature of a quote set off?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Does the bankruptcy code 553 shed light on the legal nature of a set-off? In other words, is it can it be anything in affirmative defense? Can it be a new claim? Does it have to be part of the same transaction? Is there anything in the bankruptcy code that helps us in that?
I don't really think so. I mean, we found a number of cases involving set-offs, and there was a differing nature of them. I guess it was my position that at least this particular claim was permissible under 553. The trial court agreed, and as I mentioned, that's not part of the appeal here. The plaintiff has not appealed the trial court's decision to allow us to assert the set-off. In any event, that's what we were permitted to do, was to assert this set-off claim against the plaintiff's claim that Mr. Griffiths had improperly withheld funds. We went to trial, and before the case was submitted to the jury, we reached an agreement on the calculation as to the amount of money Mr. Hoas should have received if he had been paid those corporate funds, and that was somewhere in the neighborhood of $58,000. So the jury was not asked to determine that amount. They were instructed that the parties had agreed that Mr. Hoas' share was $58,000. So really, the issues the jury was asked to determine was, number one, did Mr. Hoas steal money from the corporation, and if so, the amount, which was the set-off claim. And then secondly, Mr. Hoas was allowed to pursue a claim for punitive damages, and the jury was asked to rule on it.
The problem with that, as I see it, is that how you submitted it to the jury, which my understanding is you all agreed on the instructions and the form of the instructions that went in, and the special interrogatory to the jury on their verdict was that they first were to determine whether he was entitled to punitive damages, and then if they determined that, then they went forward and made a decision about the set-off on whether he took unauthorized funds, and then if so, how much. So the way you laid it out to the jury, it would almost appear that it was a set-off to the, that first they determined punitive damages. Under your theory of the case, it would seem to me that the second question should have been to the jury whether or not there was a unauthorized taking of funds and how much. Then if the difference was more than zero, it went to punitives. But that's not how it was presented to the jury. Now, did you ever argue that at any point, that the set-off only went to the compensatory damages?
No. In hindsight, yeah, I think I would have liked that jury verdict form to be set up differently. It wasn't such that, well, if you answer question one, you proceed to question two, and then it was just answer all these questions.
Well, that's not true, because the first one, it says, determine if there was one in there, and I don't
well,
know.
Well, yeah, it says,
determine,
yeah, if you ask, is the plaintiff entitled to punitive damages, yes or no, if you answer no, proceed to question four or whatever. Yeah, you're right about that, but as far as the punitive damage and the set-off claim, you know, they had to answer both those questions, and I agree with you. In hindsight, it would have been better to be set up the other way.
For your side.
Exactly.
But did the judge intend that the set-off be to all the damages? Because in the order originally that the judge entered, he says that he's going to allow the set-off, and it will go to any damages recovered. And he uses the word any. So was it his intention?
I think, I remember that order, and again, hindsight is great. I wish it would have said any compensatory damages. But right above there, he also refers to any damages Mr. Hoas is entitled to recover from Mr. Griffiths, and he didn't use the word compensatory there either. I think his comments at the hearing where he allowed the set-off clearly indicate that he's intending that the set-off applies to Mr. Hoas's claim against Mr. Griffiths, which makes sense in that it was Mr. Hoas's claim that Mr. Griffiths took corporate funds that he was entitled to. Well, that's exactly the same thing Mr. Griffiths was claiming, that Mr. Hoas took corporate funds he was entitled to.
But if he intended to do that, that's not how he entered the judgment in the final analysis. The judge.
Oh, the judgment, I agree. In the final analysis, the judge ruled that the set-off should apply to, well, essentially to apply to the punitive damages, since they wiped each other out.
Well, which brings me then to my next question on set-off. It's, you know, what a set-off is there isn't much, I mean, you haven't cited much, the other side hasn't either, as far as what is a definition, and it, does it just set off against compensatory or whatever? But is it, it's an equitable remedy, is my understanding. So therefore, is the judge, does the judge have some discretion on what he's going to allow that set-off to go against?
I don't think in this case that he does. I mean, because it's clear, and I agree with you, there isn't a lot of authority on set-offs in South Dakota or really elsewhere. But it's clear, if you just look at the nature of the claims, as I said, Mr. Hoas claimed that Mr. Griffiths took corporate money that belonged to him or withheld corporate money that belonged to him. Mr. Griffiths turned around and said, I did that because you already had taken corporate money that belonged to me. I mean, those were the two claims that were in dispute. And those are both clearly compensatory damage claims. I mean, they agree that their claim is compensatory damages. Well, I don't know how they can then turn around and argue that our claim isn't in the nature of compensatory damages, because they're just exactly the converse of each other.
Well, if they would have been, they would have been a counterclaim, which you weren't allowed to pursue.
Exactly.
So he allows you to have an equitable set-off, which then makes them a little, they take on a little different complexion.
I agree it takes on a little different complexion, but it's still in the nature of compensatory damages. It's still really, it's a counterclaim, but we're not allowed to call it a counterclaim because of the bankruptcy. But that's what it is. I mean, that's what the original attempt by the prior attorney was assert this counterclaim that Mr. Hoas took money that belonged to Mr. Griffiths.
Does the sequencing in determining punitives versus when you determine the set-off have any bottom line difference? Or is it just, clutters up the record? Is there a difference as to, under our law, on punitive damages, when they're recoverable, when they're not? Does that sequencing make any difference?
You mean on the verdict form?
Yes.
I don't think it has any makes any difference at all. As I said, I wish it would have been set up differently. But
right, you're just, it would have been neater and cleaner, but I'm asking you the bottom line.
No, legally no. I mean, the jury was asked to make the two determinations, which they did, and I don't think the order of the questions is of any significance whatsoever, legally speaking, no.
How did you arrive at, you claimed $135,000 was missing. Did your accountants prove that? Was that proven up?
That was the testimony, yes.
Okay. And then how did they arrive at the $58,000 that Hoss was entitled to?
$49,000 for the sale, which is 49% of $100,000. And then the corporate, we had evidence from the tax returns as to what the corporate profits were for 2000 and 2001. And his share of that was about $9,000.
So they're giving him back his share of what he stole?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's right. So I guess, you know, obviously the big issue here is the punitive damage claim. In our view, that issue should never even have gone to the jury. The court did conduct the proper pretrial hearing in that regard and determined that the issue could go to the jury, but our position was, and Mr. Griffith's position all along, was that Mr. Hoas had stolen money from the corporation and said, you know, I'm not going to give you this money that you're entitled to from the sale and from the profits since you stole money from the corporation. Later, and the jury eventually determined him to be correct in that regard. In any event, I don't believe it was shown that there was reasonable cause to believe that conduct was willful, wanton, or malicious, and so I don't believe that issue should have gone to the jury in the first place, and would ask that the court just reverse simply on that basis. But even if you agree with the trial court that it was a proper to submit the issue to the jury, the fact of the matter is that Mr. Hoas, the jury verdict was to the effect that Mr. Hoas stole $135,000, 51% of which belonged to Mr. Griffiths, and that Mr. Griffiths withheld $58,000. Mr. Hoas came out about $10,500 ahead. Those damages directly offset each other. He did not get any compensatory damages, and therefore, under clear authority, and the plaintiff doesn't dispute this authority, that in the absence of compensatory damages, punitive damages are not recoverable. And for that reason, the punitive damage verdict should be struck, and basically the parties walk away with what they have. And even under that scenario, as I mentioned, Mr. Hollis comes out $10,000 ahead, or a little more than that.
If we were to come up with a rule like that, that if there's punitives under this situation, they go first against compensatory, or set off, I mean, and then they go first against compensatory to determine whether or not you're entitled to punitives, wouldn't this work a really harsh result in some cases? Because some cases you have very few compensatory, but it's so reprehensible that the jury determines that there needs to be punitives. And wouldn't this just invite set-offs? Because a set-off can be in regard to anything. It doesn't even have to be the same scenario or the same fact basis. So wouldn't that present then a situation that anytime there's punitives, then that would invite the defendant to come up with some claim as a set-off?
Well, I think the set-off, if you could come up, I mean, normally you're not going to want to do a set-off, you're going to want to do a counterclaim. So, you know, obviously that's what we would have liked to have done, so we could have walked out of there with $10,500 in our pocket. But whether it's a counterclaim or a set-off, whatever it is, I mean, it's got to, first of all, it's got to survive a summary judgment. You can't just pick something out of the air. It's got to be some basis for it. But again, I think you would have to look at each case on an individual basis. I'm not looking for some general rule that would apply in every case, but in this case, it's clear that these two claims set each other off. And I think the comments by the trial court indicate his understanding that our claim against Mr. Hollis sets off Mr. Hollis's claim against Mr. Griffith with regard to the money they each took from the corporation. And, you know, and you mentioned reprehensible conduct. Well, I certainly wouldn't agree that Mr. Griffith's conduct was reprehensible, but even if it was, this court has stated previously that that's the reason for the rule, that no matter how reprehensible the conduct is, you can't just get punitive damages. You have to establish that you're entitled to compensatory damages. And in this case, with Mr. Griffith stealing Mr. Hollis stealing $68,000 of Griffith's money, and Griffith's only withholding $58,000 of his, he simply isn't entitled to any compensatory damages. And why in the world should he then be awarded punitive damages where the jury determined that he stole?
Well, but the jury decided.
I realize that. And, you know, it makes no sense, and I think that's maybe part of the reason for the rule, is that if you don't get compensatories, you don't get punitives.
Mr. Rasmussen, I have to, before your time expires, I got to ask you about prejudgment interest.
I was just going to
assuming that we get there, you know, under the rule, that 13.1, that issue is supposed to be submitted to the jury to determine the, and this applies to both your claim and Mr. Wild's claim. Yeah, they're supposed to determine the commencement date and the ending date. And I saw that the trial court thought there was some dispute about those dates. One of them, and I don't recall which one. It seems to me, and as I read the record, this matter never really came up until after the trial. So I'm wondering if both of these claims for prejudgment interest shouldn't just be mooted out by the fact that no one asked the jury to determine this question.
I won't speak for Mr. Wild's client on that in that regard, but to that very issue, Judge Myron, in his written ruling regarding prejudgment interest, stated, and this is in reference to our claim for prejudgment interest, although it seems clear that the money was missing by the dates the accounting adjustments were made, no determination was made by the jury as to the exact dates the money was taken. I think the trial court has the authority if the evidence is clear as to when something happens, to award prejudgment interest, and the jury does not have to be involved. In our calculations were based simply on the dates that the accounting records or the adjustments were made to show the money was gone. Clearly, the money had been taken before those dates.
Well, there is an issue then. That's what the trial court was saying.
But there isn't. The issue would be exactly when the money was taken. Well, we're not asking the court to go back to those dates. We're just asking the court to use the date that he himself says it's clear the money was missing by that date. It's undisputed. The records are there. Under that scenario, I don't believe the jury has to be involved, and I think this prior decisions of this court indicate that it wasn't essential that the jury determine the exact date the money was taken, because the dates that we picked for our calculations of prejudgment interest were totally correct. And so if the court does get to that issue, we believe we should get credit for the prejudgment interest, and as I've argued, I think in fairness, the plaintiff probably should too. I'll let him argue his point on that. And I guess I would want to make just one comment in that regard, and I discussed this with Mr. Wiles beforehand, but there's an exhibit attached to the plaintiff's brief, Exhibit 14, which is not a correct copy of the exhibit that was submitted to the trial court, and that was an oversight on Mr. Wiles' part. But it shows some prejudgment interest on that exhibit. The actual exhibit, which is in the record, does not have anything to do with prejudgment interest.
Thank you. Your time has expired, Mr. Rasmussen. Mr. Wiles, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors. As I start today, I think a little procedural history will be helpful to the court. This matter actually started in Cottington County in a lawsuit styled Grand Casino Inc. versus Hal Hoas. And in that proceeding, the corporation was suing Mr. Hoas for misappropriation of funds. They didn't proceed. They didn't follow through on that case. It got dismissed for lack of prosecution. And as a result of Mr. Hoas having been fired and not having received the proceeds that we're talking about in the case before the court, he filed a bankruptcy proceeding, which ultimately resulted in the corporation and Mr. Griffith being named in that proceeding, and they took no action to lift the stay to proceed with their case. We started this case in Aberdeen after we discovered documentary evidence that established that Griffith had sold the business without consulting my client at all and had pocketed $100,000. It's after that date that this action was started. And we came.
Was that before the bankruptcy or after?
After the bankruptcy. As a matter of fact, I think it was after the discharge of the bankruptcy. But what the bankruptcy court held is that, hey, if Hoas is entitled to recover under this case, those proceeds would be subject to the bankruptcy court, and they appointed me to proceed with this action. And on that basis, I brought this case to trial. And in doing so, we set a scheduling order for this. And in September 9th, we showed up with our jury instructions, with our exhibits, and with a motion for summary judgment, a motion for judgment on the pleadings, a motion to suppress their affirmative defense in their answer of conversion, and for punitive damages. Mr. Griffith showed up with a motion for a continuance, no response to our motion for summary judgment, and Judge Myron ruled in our favor. And he granted us a judgment on fraud, conversion, theft, and we proceeded to trial based on his opinion that he issued that says the issue of damages is before the jury. After that, Griffith's counsel got fired, and Mr. Rasmussen showed up, and on a second hearing, Judge Myron again considered the prejudgment or the motion for punitive damages and the summary judgment motion, and again ruled in favor of the plaintiff, and we proceeded to trial on that basis. He did, in his order, provide that the defendant, that pursuant to 11 U.S.C. 553, the defendant will be allowed to assert the affirmative defense. Now, you're right, Justice Meyer Henry. There is not a lot of sight on this, but if you go read 11 U.S.C. 553, what it says is that a set-off is governed by state law. Okay, now we go into the great vacuum of the state of South Dakota because we don't have, in civil procedure, a statutory set-off. The cases that have been cited, the Subserfco, as well as Mr. Rasmussen's own case in Marriott versus First National Bank of Eden, everybody had pleadings. They had a counterclaim. They had a cross-claim. Everybody was properly before the court seeking damages. Well, he's not seeking damages in this case. He doesn't have a cause of action. All he's got is an affirmative defense.
Wait a minute, though. His claim is for conversion.
I understand that.
Well, how can you say that's not a cause of action?
Damages aren't defined in South Dakota, Your Honor. And as we get into that, if you even look at 13.1, when we talk about prejudgment interest, it doesn't say you get prejudgment interest on a set-off. There's no place in South Dakota that says that a prejudgment interest constitutes a cause of action. No case law, no statutory law. If we want to do that, today's a great day. Go upstairs, grab one of the 105, go see LRC, and amend the statute. That's not the case.
That's on the prejudgment interest question, but on the punitive damage question, there's no question here that the set-off claim, whatever you want to call it, the legal nature of it was an action for conversion of corporate funds. And there's also no question that your claim was the same thing for the misuse, or whatever you want to describe, of corporate funds. Correct?
Correct.
So both sides are making claims essentially for the same thing.
Well, mine's procedural, and I'm in the book doing it the way I'm supposed to be.
Right. Okay.
Mr. Askison is equitable, and he's there because his client wasn't with the program when we went to the
I guess what I'm getting up to is, should we look at this from the procedural aspect and the name of it, or should we look to the essence of the claim to determine whether set-off offsets the compensatory damages you received?
Justice Meyer-Henry makes a good point. We have the rules of civil procedure for a reason. It gives us guidance as to how we're to proceed, and it really gives us some parameters as to how we operate. Under that theory is if I have failed to do something procedurally, I can always come in and say, hey, I get an affirmative defense of set-off. It's a ubiquitous kind of thing. It fits the occasion. Give me a definition for it, and I can't. I haven't a clue. All I know in this case, the only time the South Dakota Supreme Court has ever mentioned the word set-off has been in a case where procedurally all the parties were before the court either on a complaint or a counterclaim or a cross-claim. And under that circumstance, as an equitable matter, Judge Myron said, hey, okay, you can argue that. But under the statutes, as I read them, that's not a cause of action for damages upon which he can seek to recover. It's a set-off against anything that I may recover. And what the record shows is that I went to court with a summary judgment for $58,447 based on my claim that he'd converted the $49,000, that he'd converted the subchapter S distributions for 2000, 2001. We went to court on that. And we provided the jury with tax returns, exhibits 8 and 9 from the corporation, and 16 and 17 from Mr. Griffiths, that all established that on the dates of those tax returns, Mr. Griffiths claimed to be the sole owner of that corporation, and he converted all of the assets that were reflected on the Schedule Ks to his own use. Then we gave the jury, in Exhibit 14, Mr. Rasmussen is right, and for that I apologize. The Exhibit 14 you have was the exhibit submitted to Judge Myron for the computation of prejudgment interest. But Exhibit 14 did have each of the four headings that were that showed the exact date and the amount and how the computation was to get to the $58,477. At trial, I specifically asked Mr. Griffiths to review this particular document. And if I read from the transcript, what he said is, and it's page 149 and 150, did you take these funds? Are these the monies you took? Does this exhibit establish, you know, the monies that you took, and he agreed. Okay, I don't know how much more definitive in terms of time and date that can be, but that's what Griffith said. Now, I've been to court a number of times where we have multiple instances where damages are not just one date. That causes a problem for a jury when you have a multiple series of trying to compute prejudgment interest. It's been my experience on several occasions where the judge has said, don't ask the jury for the date, I'll determine that. We don't have an issue about whether or not it's mandatory, but it's how we go about it. Now, when we put Exhibit 14 in, we didn't compute prejudgment interest on it because of the varying dates. My thought was at the time, is that we would establish on the record those dates, and we did through Mr. Griffith. Then we go to the judge and say, all right, here's when our damages occurred. It's a date certain, and it's amount certain. Use Schedule B, use the number of days, and compute the prejudgment interest to date, and thank you. Because otherwise, you tend to confuse the jury. But I think there's enough on the record to substantiate days certain and amounts certain. That being the case, because we do have a right to recover, and we did establish compensatory damages, and the jury did award punitive damages, the offset that the defendant gets was that the jury said, all right, we're giving you punitive damages, but they're in the same amount as the claim for the set-off. So wipe out on a judgment of $127,000, $68,850, you still get $58,477, which amounts to the compensatory damages. Wherever this court has considered a set-off, it has taken it against the whole judgment, and Subservico is the best example we've got. There's no law that says, well, you first apply it to compensatory and then to punitive damages. You apply it to the verdict. And in this case, if you take away the set-off, you're right back to $58,477.
I'm still questioning, if it is a set-off and it's an equitable remedy, does the court have some discretion on what they're going to allow it to be set off against? Or, I mean, would the court have been wrong had the court redone the verdict form and said, first you decide, you know, here's what the judgment is, then you'd have to decide how much was taken, if any. If the difference is more than zero, then you go to the punitives. Would that have been wrong?
Your Honor, no. I don't know what's wrong.
Does the court have discretion on what they're going to allow the set-off against, or is that a matter of law?
I don't think there's any law on it. And I think if you look at the 11 U.S.C. 553, it says it's governed by state law. There's nothing in South Dakota to guide the judge in that regard. That's why I say go upstairs. If you want to amend the statute to provide for a set-off, then we better define what it is, and we better define how it's going to be utilized and under what circumstances. But as it stands right now, it is not a cause of action under South Dakota law, and I don't believe it constitutes a recovery of damages. I believe it's a set-off against anything that I get. But he doesn't get to get a judgment against me because he doesn't have a counterclaim or a cross-claim. He's got no enforceable right to recover anything. He just has a right to take it away from what I owe it.
Does it make a difference that in this case the judge gave a summary judgment for your client prior to the trial?
Good point. Because what Judge Myron said before a trial was, the evidence isn't just lopsided, it's one-sided. Okay, Griffith stole, he converted, he misappropriated, he abused his authority as an officer of the corporation. And the real distinction that the judge made was that he didn't do it just as a corporate officer and hold these funds as corporate funds. He took them personally. He put them in his own checking account. He invested it on his own personally. And I think that's a huge distinction, because the set-off really resulted from to the corporation, not to Mr. Griffiths. The summary judgment was against Mr. Griffiths because of his actions. And that's what Judge Myron found, is that, no, there's no question this guy did it. And he considered it three times, even after the trial, after the case in chief, and said, no, there's grounds for punitive damages. And obviously the jury agreed with it. I came before the court on a notice of review because I think the court was wrong in not granting prejudgment interest under 13.1 to the plaintiff. We came in and established compensatory damages. He made his ruling on the judgment and gave us the compensatory damages in the amount of $58,000. And I think through the exhibits at trial, Exhibit 14, the summary, and summarizing Exhibits 8 and 9 and 16 and 17, the tax returns, there's no question about when Griffith took the money. And his testimony at trial was, yeah, Exhibit 14 is a correct summary of the monies they took. And on Exhibit 14 are the dates and the computation for the funds that he took. How? I don't know what I can do beyond that to establish a certain date certain and an amount certain. Under those circumstances, I think the judge abused his discretion in not granting the plaintiff, Hoas, the prejudgment interest that's shown on the Exhibit 14 that you've got.
You know, there's an old principle of law that gets revived every now and then about, you know, you can't profit from your own wrong. Isn't your client, in effect, profiting from his own wrong?
The jury found, Your Honor, that Hoas had misappropriated or taken the $68,000. The testimony and argument at trial was that he hadn't. The $68,000, Your Honor, comes from the testimony of the deceased CPA told the bookkeeper when to put these monies in because he couldn't account for them. Hoas always denied that. Okay, there was a theft, an actual robbery that took funds, and that's what resulted in Hoas getting fired because Griffith thought he had done it, when in fact he hadn't. People were arrested, they testified at trial. Griffith was intentionally doing actions. There was nothing that was shown that Hoas had intentionally at one point in time taken $20,000 or $30,000. There were discrepancies in the books that were assigned to him. If you look at the exhibit, it said the adjustments are made per HAL. And that's made by the deceased CPA with the bookkeeper saying, well, that's what I was told to put in there. So, no. You get down to, did he do something wrong? Well, the jury thought he did. But it wasn't egregious in the sense that it was done intentionally, like Griffiths did. But the jury found that those funds were missing, and it was missing under his watch. So they gave the offset, or the set-off, excuse me. I don't think Hoas is profiting from any wrongdoing on his part, except maybe to the extent that he wasn't accounting for all the monies that came in and out of the corporation. That can either be theft or can be sloppy bookkeeping. We don't know. We know that the jury awarded the set-off in that amount. But I don't think his conduct was anything intentional like the judge found Griffith's conduct to be in converting those corporate monies and taking them for his own personal use and saying, yeah, I'm sitting on them. You can't have them. If you went through the record even further, I mean, Hoas didn't even have copies of those tax returns until we went to court. He just locked out.
Well, Mr. Wiles, though, the special interrogatory or jury verdict asked, did he take funds from the corporation, which he was not authorized to take? And the jury said, yeah, $68,850. I'd say that's wrongdoing. It looks like it's wrongdoing to me.
Well, it doesn't say he stole it. It says the testimony by all of the accounting type of folks was it's missing cash. You know, all I can tell you is that in the throes of battle, Mr. Rasmussen and I agreed that was going to be part of the special verdict.
What was that? I didn't get a chance to look. What was the jury instruction on that?
Was it defined? Instruction 9?
Was it defined as a conversion claim and all those intentional wrongful withholding type things?
Yes. I can't give you the exact number, but I think it was instruction number 9, but I can't quote it to you. I don't have it.
So the jury would have found bad things?
Bad things.
Okay.
And on top of that, then the other issue I had was that we are the prevailing party in this action. We asked for a cost and disbursements. You know, that's obviously a discretionary thing with the court. You've told us that on a number of times before. But $964 to a guy that's in bankruptcy is a lot of money. And under the circumstances, I think the judge Well, in crafting this decision, and no judge, no attorney, no offense intended, likes to come before you, but in trying to put that decision together, I think he wanted to kind of do a balancing act, so it wasn't to my advantage to appeal, and so I didn't initially, but now that I'm here, I'm asking you, because I think he was wrong. I didn't appeal the issue on set-off, because as I read South Dakota law, that was just going to come off whatever the 58,000 plus whatever we got, and it's not a cause of action. Under the circumstances, I thank you for your time, and as a matter of personal privilege, I thank you for rescheduling this matter to accommodate my schedule. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Wiles. Mr. Rasmussen, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I find it difficult to believe that Mr. Wiles can stand up here and say that the jury found it, or the judge found that Mr. Griffiths did some intentional bad acts, but they didn't find that Mr. Hoas did so. As Justice Zinter pointed out, the verdict form is very clear. At least that's one part of the verdict form I think I liked. It clearly says he took the money without authorization to do so. In answer to your question about what the jury was instructed, the jury was instructed, the defendant alleges plaintiff committed fraud, conversion, breach of fiduciary duty, misappropriation of corporate assets, and theft by taking corporate funds without authorization to do so. And then the jury was later instructed as to each of those things, conversion, breach of fiduciary duty, et cetera. And so clearly, the jury found that Mr. Hoas did wrong.
Is it significant that the exact amount is given in punitives and then taken away on the offset?
Well, I'll say we've all scratched our heads on that one, and I can't answer that question, Your Honor.
The jury also came out with a question, didn't they, about whether they could let the parties walk away without anything.
Right, they did it at one point. And so was the jury confused? I mean, I don't know. And you know, that's total speculation as to what they were doing or what they were thinking. I think what it comes down to, though, again, whatever, maybe they thought Mr. Griffiths was a bad guy, the way he withheld the money, and they somehow wanted to punish him. But the fact of the matter is that claim that we had for the set-off directly offset the compensatory damage claim. And when you do the math, he comes up with zero or less than zero for compensatory damages. And in fact, even Mr. Wiles recognized that when he's arguing his opening statement to the jury on page 28 of the transcript. He said, Mr. Griffiths claims that Hal Hoas has taken corporate funds while he was the manager and that should be an offset to any amount of money of the corporation that he took, and he offset the funds that he has in his possession. So even Mr. Wiles in his argument to the jury recognized that this was the offset was for the money that Mr. Griffiths withheld from Mr. Hoas. I get confused. And again, in the brief, we cited the comments of Judge Myron at the hearing where he allowed us to pursue the offset, or changed his opinion and let us do that. He says, so there's no confusion about it, is that the defendant had committed breach of fiduciary duty, conversion, etc., and that there was some compensation that was due as a result of that, some damages, but that was left to the jury. That will remain to the jury. In the end, it didn't, because we agreed as to the amount. But then he went on to state, that's what we will be arguing to them. The defendant will have the chance to present information regarding set-off that will help the jury make a decision about the appropriate amount. The appropriate amount being the total amount of damages that he would get for the breach of fiduciary duty, conversion, etc. And that's what our offset claim was. So again, I think it's clear that the set-off directly related to Mr. Hoas's claim against Mr. Griffiths, and in the end, Mr. Hoas received no compensatory damages and thus should receive no punitive damages.
Is that the salient difference here? If the set-off were, let's say, something entirely different, like it had to do with maybe somebody owed somebody mortgage or, you know, something that wasn't related to this corporation and the funds involved, would that make a difference?
Oh, sure.
So you're thinking that because these are so interrelated and dealt with the same transaction and the same business, that we could write a rule of law that narrow?
Well, yeah. I mean, what we're asking here is, does he get any compensatory damages? Does Mr. Hoas get any compensatory damages? And based on the jury verdict, the answer is no. He stole $68,850. Mr. Griffiths then withheld $58,000 of that amount. So he doesn't get any compensatory damages. As I said, he came out $10,500 ahead. But he did not get any compensatory damages based on the jury verdict, and therefore the punitive damages should be eliminated, just as was done with in the Schaefer versus Edward Jones case and in other cases that this court has considered. I also wanted to...
How would it be different if your client had loaned him $100,000 to go into this business, he ends up with 49%, your client has 51%, but he owes your client $100,000. Then he embezzles $58,000, and your client uses a set-off of $100,000 on the promissory note. He's still getting compensatory damages, isn't he?
Under that scenario?
Isn't he getting compensatory damages, $58,000, but it's subject to a set-off of $100,000?
Yeah.
So shouldn't he get punitive damages?
No, I don't think so, because he's...
you're saying is his compensatory damages have to exceed any kind of a set-off, no matter what the source is?
Well, not necessarily. Justice Meyer here, if we're talking about a different...
A promissory note would be a different deal.
Okay, well then in that scenario, he probably would be entitled to the punitive damages. But this, in this scenario, and I guess, you know, that would be something we'd address if that issue came up, but in this scenario, it's so clear that these two things directly offset each other that if we had a counterclaim, clearly, if we'd have been allowed to pursue the counterclaim, which I'm not saying we should have because the bankruptcy was discharged, but if we had been, Mr. Griffiths would have received $10,500. Clearly, under that scenario, the plaintiff would have received no compensatory damages and wouldn't have been entitled to any punitive damages. I don't think it's any different just because there was some errors made and Mr. Griffiths wasn't allowed to pursue the counterclaim. He still had a set-off claim, which this court has said on a number of occasions has equated a set-off claim with a counterclaim. And that's essentially what we had here. It had to be designated as something different, and we're not allowed to recover any money because of the bankruptcy.
What do you have to say about his argument on costs?
Well, on costs, I think the court clearly has a significant discretion in that regard, and he wasn't the prevailing party. We got a verdict from the jury that he stole money from us, and it was $68,000. Clearly, there was no prevailing party in this case, and the judge had total discretion to decide whether or not to award costs. And I think the cases I cite in the brief are clear to that effect. I mean, I was before this court. I won a summary judgment, and Judge Adabrafel said, well, I don't like your guy, so you don't get costs, and this court affirmed on that. And so I don't think there's really much of an issue in that regard. I did want to comment briefly on the summary judgment. I didn't get a chance. Mr. Wiles mentioned that. But I think that was an improper ruling on behalf of Judge Meyer, and I think it affected. It may be one of the reasons that the punitive damages were awarded, because the jury was instructed that Mr. Griffiths was guilty of conversion, theft, breach of fiduciary duty, and misappropriation of corporate assets. And that was based on him granting summary judgment. I don't think that was the appropriate thing to do. I mean, the evidence was Mr. Griffiths' position was that he simply withheld funds that he believed the plaintiff had stolen. And there certainly was an issue of fact then as to whether he was guilty of theft, conversion, et cetera. And that's an issue that the jury should have determined. It's not something that the judge should have taken away and essentially told the jury, well, yes, the defendant in this case is guilty of these things. That was inappropriate, and I think that definitely affected the jury's thinking. So even if you don't think the punitive damages should be thrown out, I think at a minimum we should get a remand, and the issue of punitive damages should again be addressed without the summary judgment. Finally, just briefly on the prejudgment interest, if you get to that, it's true that set-off itself is not specifically mentioned in the statute, but again, this is in the nature of a counterclaim. If, as Judge Myron mentioned in his comments, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. If the plaintiff is entitled to prejudgment interest on the money that Mr. Griffiths withheld from him, certainly we should be entitled to credit for prejudgment interest on the money that he stole from us. And so that if either side gets it, both sides should get it, I guess. I believe, unless there's no further questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmussen.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.